Paul recalled that he had sat there in his mother's quarters in the inner chamber, shrouded by dark hangings with their surfaces covered by woven patterns out of Fremen mythology. He had sat there, hearing her out, noting the way she was always observing, even when her eyes were lowered. Her oval face had new lines in it at the corners of the mouth, but the hair was still like polished bronze. The wide-set green eyes, though, hid beneath their overcasting of spice-imbued blue. "The Fremen have a simple, practical religion," he said. "Nothing about religion is simple," she warned. But Paul, seeing the clouded future that still hung over them, found himself swayed by anger. He could only say, "Religion unifies our forces. It's our mystique." "You deliberately cultivate this air, this bravura," she charged. "You never cease indoctrinating. Thus you yourself taught me," he said. But she had been full of contentions and arguments that day. It had been the day of the circumcision ceremony for little Leto. Paul had understood some of the reasons for her upset. She had never accepted his liaison, the marriage of youth with Chaney. But Chaney had produced an Atreides son, and Jessica had found herself unable to reject the child with the mother. Jessica had stirred finally under his stare, said, "You think me an unnatural mother?" "Of course not. I see the way you watch me when I'm with your sister. You don't understand about your sister." "I know why Aaliyah is different," he said. "She was unborn, part of you, when you changed the water of life. She—"
"You know nothing of it."
And Paul, suddenly unable to express the knowledge gained out of its time, said only, "I don't think you unnatural." She saw his distress, said,
"There is a thing, son."
"Yes?"
"I do love your Chaney. I accept her."
This was real, Paul told himself. This wasn't the imperfect vision, to be changed by the twistings out of time's own birth. The reassurance gave him a new hold on his world. Bits of solid reality began to dip through the dream state into his awareness. He knew suddenly that he was in a hereg, a desert camp. Chaney had planted their still tent on flower sand for its softness. That could only mean Chaney was nearby. Chaney, his soul. Chaney, his Sihaya, sweet as the desert spring. Chaney, up from the palmeries of the deep south. Now he remembered her singing a sand shanty to him in the time for sleep. "Oh, my soul, have no taste for paradise this night, and I swear by Shai Hulud you will go there, obedient to my love." And she had sung the walking song lovers shared on the sand, its rhythm like the drag of the dunes against the feet. "Tell me of thine eyes, and I will tell thee of my heart. Tell me of thy feet, and I will tell thee of thy hands. Tell me of thy sleeping, and I will tell thee of thy waking. Tell me of thy desires, and I will tell thee of thy need." He had heard someone strumming a balisette in another tent, and he thought then of Gurney Halleck. Reminded by the familiar instrument, he had thought of Gurney, whose face he had seen in a smuggler band, but who had not seen him, could not see him, or know of him, lest that inadvertently lead the Harkonnens to the son of the duke they had killed. But the style of the player in the night, the distinctiveness of the fingers on the balisette's strings, brought the real musician back to Paul's memory. It had been Chat the Leper, captain of the Fadaikin, leader of the death commanders who guarded Muad'Dib. "We are in the desert," Paul remembered. "We are in the central Urg beyond the Harkonnen patrols. I am here to walk the sand, to lure a maker and mount him by my own cunning that I may be a Fremen entire." He felt now the Mauler pistol at his belt, the kris knife. He felt the silence surrounding him. It was that special pre-morning silence when the night birds had gone and the day creatures had not yet signalled their alertness to their enemy, the sun.
"You must ride the sand in the light of day, that Shai Hulud shall see and know you have no fear," Stilgar had said. "Thus we turn our time around and set ourselves to sleep this night."
Quietly, Paul sat up, feeling the looseness of a slacked stillsuit around his body, the shadowed still tent beyond. So softly he moved. Yet Chaney heard him. She spoke from the tent's gloom, another shadow there.
"It's not yet full light, beloved."
"Sihaya," he said, speaking with half a laugh in his voice.
"You call me your desert spring," she said, "but this day I'm thy goad. I am the Sayadina who watches that the rites be obeyed."
He began tightening his stillsuit.
"You told me once the words of the Kitab Alibar," he said. "You told me, woman is thy field. Go then to thy field and till it."
"I am the mother of thy firstborn," she agreed.
He saw her in the greyness matching him movement for movement, securing her stillsuit for the open desert.
"You should get all the rest you can," she said.
He recognized her love for him speaking then and chided her gently. "The Sayadina of the Watch does not caution or warn the candidate." She slid across to his side, touched his cheek with her palm.
"Today I am both the watcher and the woman."
"You should have left this duty to another," he said.
"Waiting is bad enough at best," she said. "I'd sooner be at thy side."
He kissed her palm before securing the face flap of his suit, then turned and cracked the seal of the tent. The air that came into them held the chill, not quite dryness, that would precipitate trace dew in the dawn. With it came the smell of a pre-spice mass, the mass they had detected off to the northeast, and that told them there would be a maker nearby. Paul crawled through the sphincter opening, stood on the sand, and stretched the sleep from his muscles. A faint green-pearl luminescence etched the eastern horizon. The tents of his troop were small, false dunes around him in the gloom. He saw movement off to the left, the guard, and knew they had seen him. They knew the peril he faced this day. Each Fremen had faced it. They gave him this last few moments of isolation now that he might prepare himself.
"It must be done today," he told himself.
He thought of the power he wielded in the face of the pogrom, the old men who sent their sons to him to be trained in the weirding way of battle, the old men who listened to him now in council and followed his plans, the men who returned to pay him that highest Fremen compliment, "Your plan worked, Muad'Dib." Yet the meanest and smallest of the Fremen warriors could do a thing that he had never done, and Paul knew his leadership suffered from the omnipresent knowledge of this difference between them. He had not ridden the Maker. Oh, he'd gone up with the others for training trips and raids, but he had not made his own voyage. Until he did, his world was bounded by the abilities of others. No true Fremen could permit this. Until he did this thing himself, even the great Southlands, the area some 20 thumpers beyond the Urg, were denied him unless he ordered a palanquin and rode like a reverend mother or one of the sick and wounded. Memory returned to him of his wrestling with his inner awareness during the night. He saw a strange parallel here. If he mastered the Maker, his rule was strengthened. If he mastered the inward eye, this carried its own measure of command. But beyond them both lay the clouded area, the great unrest where all the universe seemed embroiled. The differences in the ways he comprehended the universe haunted him, accuracy matched with inaccuracy. He saw it in situ. Yet when it was born, when it came into the pressures of reality, the now had its own life and grew with its own subtle differences. Terrible purpose remained. Race consciousness remained. And over all loomed the jihad, bloody and wild. Chaney joined him outside the tent, hugging her elbows, looking up at him from the corners of her eyes the way she did when she studied his mood.
"Tell me again about the waters of thy birth world, Ussu," she said.
He saw that she was trying to distract him, ease his mind of tensions before the deadly test. It was growing lighter, and he noted that some of his Fedaikin were already striking their tents.
"I'd rather you told me about the Sietch and about our son," he said. "Does our Leto yet hold my mother in his palm?"
"It's Aliyah he holds as well," she said, "and he grows rapidly. He'll be a big man."
"What's it like in the south?" he asked.
"When you ride the Maker, you'll see for yourself," she said.
"But I wish to see it first through your eyes."
"It's powerfully lonely," she said.
He touched the Nejone scarf at her forehead where it protruded from her still-suit cap.
"Why will you not talk about the Sietch?"
"I have talked about it. The Sietch is a lonely place without our men. It's a place of work. We labour in the factories and the potting rooms. There are weapons to be made, poles to plant that we may forecast the weather, spice to collect for the bribes. There are dunes to be planted to make them grow and to anchor them. There are fabrics and rugs to make, fuel cells to charge. There are children to train, that the tribe's strength may never be lost."
"Is nothing, then, pleasant in the Sietch?" he asked.
"The children are pleasant. We observe the rites. We have sufficient food. Sometimes one of us may come north to be with her man. Life must go on."
"My sister, Aaliyah, is she accepted yet by the people?"
Cheney turned toward him in the growing dawn light. Her eyes bored into him.
"It's a thing to be discussed another time, beloved."
"Let us discuss it now."
"You should conserve your energies for the test," she said.
He saw that he had touched something sensitive, hearing the withdrawal in her voice.
"The unknown brings its own worries," he said.
Presently she nodded, said,
"There is yet misunderstanding because of Aaliyah's strangeness. The women are fearful because a child, little more than an infant, talks of things that only an adult should know. They do not understand the change in the womb that made Aaliyah different."
"There is trouble?" he asked.
And he thought, "I've seen visions of trouble over Aaliyah." Janie looked toward the growing line of the sunrise.
"Some of the women banded to appeal to the Reverend Mother. They demanded she exorcise the demon in her daughter. They quoted the scripture, 'Suffer not a witch to live among us.'"
"And what did my mother say to them?"
"She recited the law and sent the women away abashed. She said, 'If Aaliyah incites trouble, it is the fault of authority for not foreseeing and preventing the trouble.' And she tried to explain how the change had worked on Aaliyah in the womb. But the women were angry because they had been embarrassed. They went away muttering."
"There will be trouble because of Aaliyah," he thought.
A crystal blowing of sand touched the exposed portions of his face, bringing the scent of the pre-spice mass.
"El Sial, the rain of sand that brings the morning," he said.
He looked out across the grey light of the desert landscape, the landscape beyond pity, the sand that was form absorbed in itself. Dry lightning streaked a dark corner to the south, sign that a storm had built up its static charge there. The roll of thunder boomed long after.
"The voice that beautifies the land," Cheney said.
Most of his men were stirring out of their tents. Guards were coming in from the rims. Everything around him moved smoothly in the ancient routine that required no orders.
"Give as few orders as possible," his father had told him.
Once, long ago.
"Once you've given orders on a subject, you must always give orders on that subject."
The Fremen knew this rule instinctively. The troops' watermaster began the morning shanty, adding to it now the call for the right to initiate a sand rider.
"The world is a carcass," the man chanted, his voice wailing across the dunes. "Who can turn away the angel of death? What Shai Hulud has decreed must be."
Paul listened, recognizing that these were the words that also began the death chant of his Fedaikin, the words the death commandos recited as they hurled themselves into battle.
"Will there be a rock shrine here this day to mark the passing of another soul?" Paul asked himself. "Will Fremen stop here in the future, each to add another stone and think of Muad'Dib who died in this place?"
He knew this was among the alternatives today, a fact along lines of the future radiating from this position in time-space. The imperfect vision plagued him. The more he resisted his terrible purpose and fought against the coming of the jihad, the greater the turmoil that wove through his prescience. His entire future was becoming like a river hurtling toward a chasm, the violent nexus beyond which all was fog and clouds.
"Stilgar approaches," Cheney said. "I must stand apart now, beloved. Now I must be Sayadina and observe the rite that it may be reported truly in the chronicles."
She looked up at him, and for a moment her reserve slipped. Then she had herself under control.
When this is past, I shall prepare thy breakfast with my own hands, she said.
She turned away. Stilgar moved toward him across the flower sand, stirring up little dust puddles. The dark niches of his eyes remained steady on Paul with their untamed stare. The glimpse of black beard above the stillsuit mask, the lines of craggy cheeks, could have been wind-etched from the native rock for all their movement. The man carried Paul's banner on its staff, the green and black banner with a water tube in the staff that already was a legend in the land. Half pridefully, Paul thought, I cannot do the simplest thing without its becoming a legend. They will mark how I parted from Chaney, how I greet Stilgar, every move I make this day. Live or die, it is a legend. I must not die. Then it will be only legend, and nothing to stop the jihad. Stilgar planted the staff in the sand beside Paul, dropped his hands to his sides. The blue within blue eyes remained level and intent, and Paul thought how his own eyes already were assuming this mask of colour from the spice.
They denied us the Hajj, Stilgar said with ritual solemnity.
As Chaney had taught him, Paul responded, Who can deny a Fremen the right to walk or ride where he wills?
I am a Naib, Stilgar said, never to be taken alive. I am a leg of the death tripod that will destroy our foes.
Silence settled over them. Paul glanced at the other Fremen scattered over the sand beyond Stilgar, at the way they stood without moving for this moment of personal prayer, and he thought of how the Fremen were a people whose living consisted of killing, an entire people who had lived with rage and grief all of their days, never once considering what might take the place of either, except for a dream with which Liet Kynes had infused them before his death.
"Where is the Lord who led us through the land of desert and of pits?" Stilgar asked.
"He is ever with us," the Fremen chanted.
Stilgar squared his shoulders, stepped closer to Paul and lowered his voice.
"Now remember what I told you. Do it simply and directly, nothing fancy. Among our people we ride the Maker at the age of 12. You are more than 6 years beyond that age and not born to this life. You don't have to impress anyone with your courage. We know you are brave. All you must do is call the Maker and ride him.
I will remember, Paul said. See that you do.
I'll not have you shame my teaching.
Stilgar pulled a plastic rod about a meter long from beneath his robe. The thing was pointed at one end, had a spring-wound clapper at the other end.
I prepared this thumper myself. It's a good one. Take it.
Paul felt the warm smoothness of the plastic as he accepted the thumper.
"Shishakli has your hooks," Stilgar said. "He'll hand them to you as you step out onto that dune over there."
He pointed to his right.
"Call a big Maker, Usul. Show us the way."
Paul marked the tone of Stilgar's voice, half ritual and half that of a worried friend. In that instant the sun seemed to bound above the horizon. The sky took on the silvered grey-blue that warned this day would be a day of extreme heat and dryness even for Arrakis.
"It is the time of the scalding day," Stilgar said, and now his voice was entirely ritual. "Go, Usul, and ride the Maker. Travel the sand as a leader of men."
Paul saluted his banner, noting how the green and black flag hung limply now that the dawn wind had died. He turned toward the dune Stilgar had indicated, a dirty tan slope with an S-track crest. Already most of the troop was moving out in the opposite direction, climbing the other dune that had sheltered their camp. One robed figure remained in Paul's path. Shishakli, a squad leader of the Vadaikin, only his slope-lidded eyes visible between stillsuit cap and mask. Shishakli presented two thin, whip-like shafts as Paul approached. The shafts were about a meter and a half long, with glistening plasteel hooks at one end, roughened at the other end for a firm grip. Paul accepted them both in his left hand as required by the ritual.
"They are my own hooks," Shishakli said in a husky voice. "They never have failed."
Paul nodded, maintaining the necessary silence, moved past the men and up the dune slope. At the crest he glanced back, saw the troop scattering like a flight of insects, their robes fluttering. He stood alone now on the sandy ridge, with only the horizon in front of him, the flat and unmoving horizon. This was a good dune Stilgar had chosen, higher than its companions for the viewpoint vantage. Stooping, Paul planted the thumper deep into the windward face where the sand was compacted and would give maximum transmission to the drumming. Then he hesitated, reviewing the lessons, reviewing the life and death necessities that faced him. When he threw the latch, the thumper would begin its summons. Across the sand, a giant worm, a maker, would hear and come to the drumming. With whip-like hookstaffs, Paul knew, he could mount the maker's high, curving back. For as long as a forward edge of a worm's ring segment was held open by a hook, open to admit abrasive sand into the more sensitive interior, the creature would not retreat beneath the desert. It would, in fact, roll its gigantic body to bring the opened segment as far away from the desert surface as possible. "I am a sand rider," Paul told himself. He glanced down at the hooks in his left hand, thinking that he had only to shift those hooks down the curve of a maker's immense side to make the creature roll and turn, guiding it where he willed. He had seen it done. He had been helped up the side of a worm for a short ride in training. The captive worm could be ridden until it lay exhausted and quiescent upon the desert surface, and a new maker must be summoned. Once he was past this test, Paul knew, he was qualified to make the 20-thumper journey into the Southland, to rest and restore himself, into the south, where the women and the families had been hidden from the pogrom among the new palmeries and Siech warrens. He lifted his head and looked to the south, reminding himself that the maker summoned wild from the Urg was an unknown quantity, and the one who summoned it was equally unknown to this test.
"You must gauge the approaching maker carefully," Stilgar had explained. "You must stand close enough that you can mount it as it passes, yet not so close that it engulfs you."
With abrupt decision, Paul released the thumper's latch. The clapper began revolving, and the summons drummed through the sand, a measured lump, lump, lump. He straightened, scanning the horizon. Remembering Stilgar's words,
"Judge the line of approach carefully. Remember, a worm seldom makes an unseen approach to a thumper. Listen all the same. You may often hear it before you see it."
And Chaney's words of caution, whispered at night when her fear for him overcame her, filled his mind.
"When you take your stand along the maker's path, you must remain utterly still. You must think like a patch of sand. Hide beneath your cloak and become a little dune in your very essence."
Slowly he scanned the horizon, listening, watching for the signs he had been taught. It came from the southeast, a distant hissing, a sand whisper. Presently he saw the faraway outline of the creature's track against the dawn light and realized he had never before seen a maker this large, never heard of one this size. It appeared to be more than half a league long, and the rise of the sand wave at its cresting head was like the approach of a mountain.
"This is nothing I have seen by vision or in life," Paul cautioned himself.
He hurried across the path of the thing to take his stand, caught up entirely by the rushing needs of this moment.
Control the coinage and the courts. Let the rabble have the rest. Thus the Padishah Emperor advised you, and he tells you, if you want profits, you must rule. There is truth in these words, but I ask myself, who are the rabble and who are the ruled? Muad'Dib's secret message to the Landsraad, from Arrakis Awakening by the Princess Irulan.
A thought came unbidden to Jessica's mind.
Paul will be undergoing his sand rider test at any moment now. They try to conceal this fact from me, but it's obvious. And Chaney has gone on some mysterious errand.
Jessica sat in her resting chamber, catching a moment of quiet between the night's classes. It was a pleasant chamber, but not as large as the one she had enjoyed in Sietch Tabor before their flight from the pogrom. Still, this place had thick rugs on the floor, soft cushions, a low coffee table near at hand, multicoloured hangings on the walls, and soft yellow glow globes overhead. The room was permeated with a distinctive, acrid, furry odour of a Fremen Sietch that she had come to associate with a sense of security. Yet she knew she would never overcome a feeling of being in an alien place. It was the harshness that the rugs and hangings attempted to conceal. A faint, tinkling, drumming, slapping penetrated to the resting chamber. Jessica knew it for a birth celebration, probably Soubier's. Her time was near. And Jessica knew she'd see the baby soon enough, a blue-eyed cherub brought to the Reverend Mother for blessing. She knew also that her daughter, Alia, would be at the celebration and would report on it. It was not yet time for the nightly prayer of parting. They wouldn't have started a birth celebration near the time of ceremony that mourned the slave raids of Porotrin, Beletaguz, Rossac, and Harmonthep. Jessica sighed. She knew she was trying to keep her thoughts off her son and the dangers he faced, the pit traps with their poisoned barbs, the Harkonnen raids, although these were growing fewer as the Fremen took their toll of aircraft and raiders with the new weapons Paul had given them, and the natural dangers of the desert makers, and thirst, and dust chasms. She thought of calling for coffee, and with the thought came that ever-present awareness of paradox in the Fremen way of life, how well they lived in these Sietch caverns compared to the Graben peons, yet how much more they endured in the open Hadra of the desert than anything the Harkonnen bondsmen endured. A dark hand inserted itself through the hangings beside her, deposited a cup upon the table, and withdrew. From the cup arose the aroma of spiced coffee. An offering from the birth celebration, Jessica thought. She took the coffee and sipped it, smiling at herself. In what other society of our universe, she asked herself, could a person of my station accept an anonymous drink and quaff that drink without fear? I could alter any poison now before it did me harm, of course, but the donor doesn't realize this. She drained the cup, feeling the energy and lift of its contents, hot and delicious. And she wondered what other society would have such a natural regard for her privacy and comfort that the giver would intrude only enough to deposit the gift and not inflict her with the donor. Respect and love had sent the gift, with only a slight tinge of fear. Another element of the incident forced itself into her awareness. She had thought of coffee, and it had appeared. There was nothing of telepathy here, she knew. It was the Tao, the oneness of the Sietch community, a compensation from the subtle poison of the spice diet they shared. The great mass of the people could never hope to attain the enlightenment the spice seed brought to her. They had not been trained and prepared for it. Their minds rejected what they could not understand or encompass. Still, they felt and reacted sometimes like a single organism. And the thought of coincidence never entered their minds. "Has Paul passed his test on the sand?" Jessica asked herself. "He's capable, but accident can strike down even the most capable." The waiting. "It's the dreariness," she thought. "You can wait just so long, then the dreariness of the waiting overcomes you." There was all manner of waiting in their lives. "More than 2 years we've been here," she thought, "and twice that number at least to go before we can even hope to think of trying to wrest Arrakis from the Harkonnen governor, the Mudir Naya, the beast Raban." "Reverend Mother?" The voice from outside the hangings at her door was that of Hera, the other woman in Paul's menage. "Yes, Hera?" The hangings parted, and Hera seemed to glide through them. She wore Sietch sandals, a red-yellow wraparound that exposed her arms almost to the shoulders. Her black hair was parted in the middle and swept back like the wings of an insect, flat and oily against her head. The jutting, predatory features were drawn into an intense frown. Behind Hera came Alia, a girl child of about 2 years. seeing her daughter Jessica was caught, as she frequently was, by Aaliyah's resemblance to Paul at that age, the same wide-eyed solemnity to her questing look, the dark hair and firmness of mouth. But there were subtle differences, too, and it was in these that most adults found Aaliyah disquieting. The child, little more than a toddler, carried herself with a calmness and awareness beyond her years. Adults were shocked to find her laughing at a subtle play of words between the sexes, or they'd catch themselves listening to her half-lisping voice, still blurred as it was by an unformed soft palate, and discover in her words sly remarks that could only be based on experiences no two-year-old had ever encountered. Hera sank to a cushion with an exasperated sigh, frowned at the child. "Aaliyah?" Jessica motioned to her daughter. The child crossed to a cushion beside her mother, sank to it and clasped her mother's hand. The contact of flesh restored that mutual awareness they had shared since before Aaliyah's birth. It wasn't a matter of shared thoughts, although there were bursts of that if they touched while Jessica was changing the spice poison for a ceremony. It was something larger, an immediate awareness of another living spark, a sharp and poignant thing, a nerve simpatico that made them emotionally one. In the formal manner that befitted a member of her son's household, Jessica said, "Subak al-Kuhar, Hera. This night finds you well?" With the same traditional formality, she said, "Subak on-Nar, I am well." The words were almost toneless. Again she sighed. Jessica sensed amusement from Aaliyah.
"My brother's Ghanima is annoyed with me,"
Aaliyah said in her half-lisp. Jessica marked the term Aaliyah used to refer to Hera, Ghanima. In the subtleties of the Fremen tongue, the word meant something acquired in battle, and with the added overtone that the something no longer was used for its original purpose, an ornament, a spearhead used as a curtain weight. Hera scowled at the child.
"Don't try to insult me, child. I know my place."
"What have you done this time, Aaliyah?" Jessica asked.
Hera answered,
"Not only has she refused to play with the other children today, but she intruded where I hid behind the hangings and watched Subie's child being born," Aaliyah said. "It's a boy. He cried and cried. What a set of lungs. When he cried long enough, she came out and touched him," Hera said, "and he stopped crying. Everyone knows a Fremen baby must get his crying done at birth, if he's in Siege, because he can never cry again lest he betray us on Hajar." "He'd cried enough," Aaliyah said. "I just wanted to feel his spark, his life, that's all. And when he felt me, he didn't want to cry any more."
"It's just made more talk among the people," Hera said.
"Subie's boy is healthy?" Jessica asked.
She saw that something was troubling Hera deeply and wondered at it.
"Healthy as any mother could ask," Hera said. "They know Aaliyah didn't hurt him. They didn't so much mind her touching him. He settled down right away and was happy. I was..."
Hera shrugged.
"It's the strangeness of my daughter. Is that it?" Jessica asked.
"It's the way she speaks of things beyond her years, and of things no child her age could know. Things of the past." "How could she know what a child looked like on Bella Tegus?" Hera demanded. "But he does," Aaliyah said. "Subie's boy looks just like the son of Mitha, born before the parting."
"Aaliyah," Jessica said,
"I warned you." "But, mother, I saw it, and it was true, and—"
Jessica shook her head, seeing the signs of disturbance in Hera's face.
"What have I borne?" Jessica asked herself. "A daughter who knew at birth everything that I knew. And more. Everything revealed to her out of the corridors of the past by the reverend mothers within me."
"It's not just the things she says," Hera said. "It's the exercises, too. The way she sits and stares at a rock, moving only one muscle beside her nose, or a muscle on the back of a finger, or—"
"Those are the Bene Gesserit training," Jessica said. "You know that, Hera. Would you deny my daughter her inheritance?"
"Reverend Mother, you know these things don't matter to me," Hera said. "It's the people and the way they mutter. I feel danger in it. They say your daughter's a demon, that other children refuse to play with her, that she's—"
"She has so little in common with the other children," Jessica said.
"She's no demon. It's just the—" "Of course she's not."
Jessica found herself surprised at the vehemence in Hera's tone, glanced down at Alia. The child appeared lost in thought, radiating a sense of waiting. Jessica returned her attention to Hera.
"I respect the fact that you're a member of my son's household," Jessica said.
Alia stirred against her hand.
"You may speak openly with me of whatever's troubling you."
"I will not be a member of your son's household much longer," Hera said. "I've waited this long for the sake of my sons, the special training they receive as the children of Usul. It's little enough I could give them since it's known I don't share your son's bed."
Again Alia stirred beside her, half sleeping, warm.
"You'd have made a good companion for my son, though," Jessica said.
And she added to herself, because such thoughts were ever with her,
"Companion, not a wife."
Jessica's thoughts went then straight to the centre, to the pang that came from the common talk in the Sietch that her son's companionship with Chaney had become a permanent thing, the marriage.
"I love Chaney," Jessica thought.
But she reminded herself that love might have to step aside for royal necessity. Royal marriages had other reasons than love.
"You think I don't know what you planned for your son?" Hera asked.
"What do you mean?"
Jessica demanded.
"You plan to unite the tribes under him,"
Hera said. "Is that bad?"
"I see danger for him, and Alia is part of that danger."
Alia nestled closer to her mother, eyes opened now and studying Hera.
"I've watched you two together," Hera said, "the way you touch. And Alia is like my own flesh because she's sister to one who is like my brother. I've watched over her and guarded her from the time she was a mere baby, from the time of the razzia when we fled here. I've seen many things about her."
Jessica nodded, feeling disquiet begin to grow in Alia beside her.
"You know what I mean," Hera said, "the way she knew from the first what we were saying to her. When has there been another baby who knew the water discipline so young? What other baby's first words to her nurse were, 'I love you, Hera.'"
Hera stared at Alia.
"Why do you think I accept her insults? I know there's no malice in them."
Alia looked up at her mother.
"Yes, I have reasoning powers, Reverend Mother," Hera said. "I could have been of the Sayyidina. I have seen what I have seen."
"Hera," Jessica shrugged, "I don't know what to say."
And she felt surprise at herself, because this literally was true. Alia straightened, squared her shoulders. Jessica felt the sense of waiting ended, an emotion compounded of decisions and sadness.
"We made a mistake," Alia said. "Now we need Hera." "It was the ceremony of the seed," Hera said, "when you changed the water of life, Reverend Mother, when Alia was yet unborn within you."
"Need Hera?" Jessica asked herself.
"Who else can talk among the people and make them begin to understand me?" Alia asked.
"What would you have her do?" Jessica asked.
"She already knows what to do," Alia said. "I will tell them the truth," Hera said.
Her face seemed suddenly old and sad, with its olive skin drawn into frown wrinkles, a witchery in the sharp features.
"I will tell them that Alia only pretends to be a little girl, that she has never been a little girl."
Alia shook her head. Tears ran down her cheeks, and Jessica felt the wave of sadness from her daughter as though the emotion were her own.
"I know I'm a freak," Alia whispered.
The adult summation coming from the child mouth was like a bitter confirmation.
"You're not a freak," Hera snapped. "Who dared say you're a freak?"
Again, Jessica marvelled at the fierce note of protectiveness in Hera's voice. Jessica saw then that Alia had judged correctly. They did need Hera. The tribe would understand Hera, both her words and her emotions, for it was obvious she loved Alia as though this were her own child.
"Who said it?"
Hera repeated.
"Nobody."
Alia used a corner of Jessica's abba to wipe the tears from her face. She smoothed the robe where she had dampened and crumpled it.
"Then don't you say it," Hera ordered.
"Yes, Hera."
"Now,"
Hera said,
"you may tell me what it was like so that I may tell the others. Tell me what it is that happened to you."
Aaliyah swallowed, looked up at her mother. Jessica nodded.
One day I woke up, Aaliyah said. It was like waking from sleep, except that I could not remember going to sleep. I was in a warm, dark place, and I was frightened.
Listening to the half-lisping voice of her daughter, Jessica remembered that day in the big cavern.
When I was frightened, Aaliyah said, I tried to escape, but there was no way to escape. Then I saw a spark. But it wasn't exactly like seeing it. The spark was just there with me, and I felt the spark's emotions, soothing me, comforting me, telling me that way that everything would be all right. That was my mother.
Hera rubbed at her eyes, smiled reassuringly at Aaliyah. Yet there was a look of wildness in the eyes of the Fremen woman, an intensity as though they, too, were trying to hear Aaliyah's words. And Jessica thought, what do we really know of how such a one thinks? Out of her unique experiences and training and ancestry.
Just when I felt safe and reassured, Aaliyah said, there was another spark with us. And everything was happening at once. The other spark was the old Reverend Mother. She was trading lives with my mother, everything. And I was there with them, seeing it all, everything. And it was over, and I was them, and all the others, and myself. Only it took me a long time to find myself again. There were so many others.
It was a cruel thing, Jessica said. No one should wake into consciousness thus. The wonder of it is you could accept all that happened to you.
I couldn't do anything else, Aaliyah said. I didn't know how to reject or hide my consciousness, or shut it off. Everything just happened. Everything.
We didn't know, Hera murmured. When we gave your mother the water to change, we didn't know you existed within her.
Don't be sad about it, Hera, Aaliyah said. I shouldn't feel very sorry for myself. After all, there's cause for happiness here. I'm a Reverend Mother. The tribe has two
She broke off, tipped her head to listen. Hera rocked back on her heels against the sitting cushion, stared at Aaliyah, bringing her attention then up to Jessica's face.
Didn't you suspect? Jessica asked.
Shh, Aaliyah said.
A distant, rhythmic chanting came to them through the hangings that separated them from the CH corridors. It grew louder, carrying distinct sounds now.
Yayayom! Yayayom! Mutain! Walla! Yayayom! Mutain! Walla!
The chanters passed the outer entrance, and their voices boomed through to the inner apartments. Slowly the sound receded. When the sound had dimmed sufficiently, Jessica began the ritual, the sadness in her voice.
It was Ramadan and April on Bella Tegus. My family sat in their pool courtyard, Hera said, in air bathed by the moisture that arose from the spray of a fountain. There was a tree of portugals, round and deep in colour, near at hand. There was a basket with mishmish and baklava, and mugs of liban, all manner of good things to eat. In our gardens and in our flocks there was peace, peace in all the land. Life was full with happiness, until the raiders came, Aaliyah said. Blood ran cold at the scream of friends, Jessica said,
and she felt the memories rushing through her out of all those other pasts she shared.
La la la, the women cried, said Hera. The raiders came through the Mushtamal, rushing at us with their knives dripping red from the lives of our men, Jessica said.
Silence came over the three of them, as it was in all the apartments of the CH, the silence while they remembered and kept their grief thus fresh. Presently Hera uttered the ritual ending to the ceremony, giving the words a harshness that Jessica had never before heard in them.
"We will never forgive, and we will never forget," Hera said.
In the thoughtful quiet that followed her words, they heard a muttering of people, the swish of many robes. Jessica sensed someone standing beyond the hangings that shielded her chamber.
"Reverend Mother?"
A woman's voice, and Jessica recognized it, the voice of Tharthar, one of Stilgar's wives.
What is it, Tharthar?
There is trouble, Reverend Mother.
Jessica felt a constriction at her heart, an abrupt fear for Paul.
Paul,
she gasped. Farfar spread the hangings, stepped into the chamber. Jessica glimpsed a press of people in the outer room before the hangings fell. She looked up at Tharthar, a small, dark woman in a red-figured robe of black, the total blue of her eyes trained fixedly on Jessica, the nostrils of her tiny nose dilated to reveal the plug scars.
"What is it?"
Jessica demanded.
"There is word from the sand,"
Tharthar said.
"Usul meets the Maker for his test. It is today. The young men say he cannot fail. He will be a sand-rider by nightfall. The young men are banding for a razzia. They will raid in the north and meet Usul there. They say they will raise the cry then. They say they will force him to call out Stilgar and assume command of the tribes.
Gathering water, planting the dunes, changing their world slowly but surely, these are no longer enough, Jessica thought. The little raids, the certain raids, these are no longer enough now that Paul and I have trained them. They feel their power. They want to fight. Tharthar shifted from one foot to the other, cleared her throat.
We know the need for cautious waiting, Jessica thought. But there's the core of our frustration. We know also the harm that waiting extended too long can do us.
We lose our sense of purpose if the waiting's prolonged.
The young men say if Usul does not call out Stilgar, then he must be afraid, Tharthar said.
She lowered her gaze. So that's the way of it, Jessica muttered, and she thought, well, I saw it coming, as did Stilgar. Again Tharthar cleared her throat.
Even my brother, Shoab, says it, she said. They will leave Usul no choice.
Then it has come, Jessica thought, and Paul will have to handle it himself. The Reverend Mother dare not become involved in the succession. Aaliyah freed her hand from her mother's, said,
I will go with Tharthar and listen to the young men. Perhaps there is a way.
Jessica met Tharthar's gaze, but spoke to Aaliyah.
Go, then, and report to me as soon as you can. We do not want this thing to happen, Reverend Mother, Tharthar said.
We do not want it, Jessica agreed. The tribe needs all its strength. She glanced at Hera.
Will you go with them?
Hera answered the unspoken part of the question.
Tharthar will allow no harm to befall Aaliyah. She knows we will soon be wives together, she and I, to share the same man. We have talked, Tharthar and I.
Hera looked up at Tharthar, back to Jessica.
We have an understanding.
Tharthar held out a hand for Aaliyah, said,
We must hurry. The young men are leaving.
They pressed through the hangings, the child's hand in the small woman's hand. But the child seemed to be leading.
If Paul Muad'Dib slays Stilgar, this will not serve the tribe, Hera said. Always before, it has been the way of succession. But times have changed.
Times have changed for you as well, Jessica said.
You cannot think I doubt the outcome of such a battle, Hera said. Usul could not but win.
That was my meaning, Jessica said.
And you think my personal feelings enter into my judgment, Hera said.
She shook her head, her water rings tinkling at her neck.
How wrong you are! Perhaps you think as well that I regret not being the chosen of Usul, that I am jealous of Chaney.
You make your own choice as you are able, Jessica said.
I pity Chaney, Hera said.
Jessica stiffened.
What do you mean? I know what you think of Chaney, Hera said. You think she is not the wife for your son.
Jessica settled back, relaxed on her cushions. She shrugged.
Perhaps. You could be right, Hera said. If you are, you may find a surprising ally, Chaney herself. She wants whatever is best for him.
Jessica swallowed past a sudden tightening in her throat.
Chaney's very dear to me, she said. She could be no... Your rugs are very dirty in here, Hera said.
She swept her gaze around the floor, avoiding Jessica's eyes.
So many people tramping through here all the time. You really should have them cleaned more often.
You cannot avoid the interplay of politics within an Orthodox religion. This power struggle permeates the training, educating, and disciplining of the Orthodox community. Because of this pressure, the leaders of such a community inevitably must face that ultimate internal question. To succumb to complete opportunism as the price of maintaining their rule, or risk sacrificing themselves for the sake of the orthodox ethic. From Muad'Dib, The Religious Issues, by the Princess Irulan.
Paul waited on the sand outside the gigantic Maker's line of approach. I must not wait like a smuggler, impatient and jittering, he reminded himself. I must be part of the desert. The thing was only minutes away now, filling the morning with a friction hissing of its passage, its great teeth within the cavern circle of its mouth spread like some enormous flower. The spice odor from it dominated the air. Paul's stillsuit rode easily on his body, and he was only distantly aware of his nose plugs, the breathing mask. Stilgar's teaching, the painstaking hours on the sand, overshadowed all else.
How far outside the Maker's radius must you stand in Peasand?
Stilgar had asked him, and he had answered correctly. Half a meter for every meter of the Maker's diameter.
Why?
To avoid the vortex of its passage and still have time to run in and mount it.
You've ridden the little ones bred for the seed and the water of life, Stilgar had said. But what you'll summon for your test is a wild Maker, an old man of the desert. You must have proper respect for such a one.
Now the thumper's deep drumming blended with a hiss of the approaching worm. Paul breathed deeply, smelling mineral bitterness of sand even through his filters. The wild Maker, the old man of the desert, loomed almost on him, its cresting front segments through a sand wave that would sweep across his knees.
Come up, you lovely monster, he thought. Up! You hear me calling? Come up! Come up!
The wave lifted his feet. Surface dust swept across him. He steadied himself, his world dominated by the passage of that sand-clouded curving wall, that segmented cliff, the ring lines sharply defined in it. Paul lifted his hooks, sighted along them, leaned in. He felt them bite and pull. He leaped upward, planting his feet against that wall, leaning out against the clinging barbs. This was the true instant of the testing. If he had planted the hooks correctly at the leading edge of a ring segment, opening the segment, the worm would not roll down and crush him. The worm slowed. It glided across the thumper, silencing it. Slowly, it began to roll. Up, up, bringing those irritant barbs as high as possible, away from the sand that threatened the soft inner lapping of its ring segment. Paul found himself riding upright, atop the worm. He felt exultant, like an emperor surveying his world. He suppressed a sudden urge to cavort there, to turn the worm, to show off his mastery of this creature. Suddenly he understood why Stilgar had warned him once about brash young men who danced and played with these monsters, doing handstands on their backs, removing both hooks and replanting them before the worm could spill them. Leaving one hook in place, Paul released the other and planted it lower down the side. When the second hook was firm and tested, he brought down the first one, thus worked his way down the side. The Maker rolled, and as it rolled, it turned, coming around the sweep of flower sand where the others waited. Paul saw them come up, using their hooks to climb, but avoiding the sensitive ring edges until they were on top. They rode at last in a triple line behind him, steadied against their hooks. Stilgar moved up through the ranks, checking the positioning of Paul's hooks, glanced up at Paul's smiling face.
"You did it, eh?"
Stilgar asked, raising his voice above the hiss of their passage.
"That's what you think? You did it?"
He straightened.
"Now I tell you that was a very sloppy job. We have 12-year-olds who do better. There was drum sand to your left where you waited. You could not retreat there if the worm turned that way."
The smile slipped from Paul's face.
"I saw the drum sand. Then why did you not signal for one of us to take up a position secondary to you? It was a thing you could do even in the test."
Paul swallowed, faced into the wind of their passage.
"You think it bad of me to say this now," Stilgar said. "It is my duty. I think of your worth to the troop. If you had stumbled into that drum sand, the Maker would have turned toward you."
In spite of a surge of anger, Paul knew that Stilgar spoke the truth. It took a long minute and the full effort of the training he had received from his mother for Paul to recapture a feeling of calm.
"I apologize," he said. "It will not happen again."
"In a tight position, always leave yourself a secondary. Someone to take the Maker if you cannot," Stilgar said. "Remember that we work together. That way we're certain. We work together, eh?"
He slapped Paul's shoulder.
"We work together," Paul agreed.
"Now," Stilgar said, and his voice was harsh, "show me you know how to handle a Maker. Which side are we on?"
Paul glanced down at the scaled ring surface on which they stood, noted the character and size of the scales, the way they grew larger off to his right, smaller to his left. Every worm he knew moved characteristically, with one side up more frequently. As it grew older, the characteristic up side became an almost constant thing. Bottom scales grew larger, heavier, smoother. Top scales could be told by size alone on a big worm. Shifting his hooks, Paul moved to the left. He motioned flankers down to open segments along the side and keep the worm on a straight course as it rolled. When he had it turned, he motioned two steersmen out of the line and into positions ahead.
"Ach! Hi-yo!"
he shouted in the traditional call. The left-side steersman opened a ring segment there. In a majestic circle, the Maker turned to protect its open segment. Full around it came, and when it was headed back to the south, Paul shouted,
"Gero!"
The steersman released his hook. The Maker lined out in a straight course. Stilgar said,
"Very good, Paul Muad'Dib. With plenty of practice, you may yet become a sand rider."
Paul frowned, thinking, "Was I not first up?" From behind him there came sudden laughter. The troop began chanting, flinging his name against the sky.
"Muad'Dib! Muad'Dib! Muad'Dib! Muad'Dib!"
And far to the rear along the worm's surface, Paul heard the beat of the goaders pounding the tail segments. The worm began picking up speed. Their robes flapped in the wind. The abrasive sound of their passage increased. Paul looked back through the troop, found Chaney's face among them. He looked at her as he spoke to Stilgar.
"Then I am a sand rider still?"
"Halyom! You are a sand rider this day."
"Then I may choose our destination?"
"That's the way of it.
And I am a Fremen born this day here in the Habanya Erg? I have had no life before this day. I was as a child until this day."
"Not quite a child," Stilgar said.
He fastened a corner of his hood where the wind was whipping it.
"But there was a cork sealing off my world, and that cork has been pulled."
"There is no cork."
"I would go south, Stilgar, 20 thumpers. I would see this land we make, this land that I've only seen through the eyes of others. And I would see my son and my family," he thought. "I need time now to consider the future that is a past within my mind. The turmoil comes, and if I'm not where I can unravel it, the thing will run wild."
Stilgar looked at him with a steady, measuring gaze. Paul kept his attention on Chaney, seeing the interest quicken in her face, noting also the excitement his words had kindled in the troop.
"The men are eager to raid with you in the Harkonnen Sinks," Stilgar said. "The Sinks are only a thumper away."
"The Verdaikin have raided with me," Paul said. "They'll raid with me again until no Harkonnen breathes Arakeen air."
Stilgar studied him as they rode, and Paul realized that the man was seeing this moment through the memory of how he had risen to command of the Tabor Siech and to leadership of the Council of Leaders now that Liet Kynes was dead. "He has heard the reports of unrest among the young Fremen," Paul thought.
"Do you wish a gathering of the leaders?" Stilgar asked.
Eyes blazed among the young men of the troop. They swayed as they rode, and they watched, and Paul saw the look of unrest in Chaney's glance, the way she looked from Stilgar, who was her uncle, to Paul Muad'Dib, who was her mate.
"You cannot guess what I want," Paul said.
And he thought, "I cannot back down. I must hold control over these people."
"You are Mudir of the Sandride this day," Stilgar said. Cold formality rang in his voice. "How do you use this power?"
"We need time to relax, time for cool reflection," Paul thought. "We shall go south," Paul said.
Even if I say we shall turn back to the north when this day is over?
We shall go south, Paul repeated. A sense of inevitable dignity enfolded Stilgar as he pulled his robe tightly around him.
There will be a gathering, he said. I will send the messages.
He thinks I will call him out, Paul thought, and he knows he cannot stand against me. Paul faced south, feeling the wind against his exposed cheeks, thinking of the necessities that went into his decisions. They do not know how it is, he thought. But he knew he could not let any consideration deflect him. He had to remain on the central line of the time storm he could see in the future. There would come an instant when it could be unravelled, but only if he were where he could cut the central knot of it. I will not call him out if it can be helped, he thought. If there's another way to prevent the jihad.
We'll camp for the evening meal and prayer at Cave of Birds beneath Habania Ridge, Stilgar said.
He steadied himself with one hook against the swaying of the Maker, gestured ahead at a low rock barrier rising out of the desert. Paul studied the cliff, the great streaks of rock crossing it like waves. No green, no blossom softened that rigid horizon. Beyond it stretched the way to the southern desert, a course of at least 10 days and nights, as fast as they could goad the Makers. 20 thumpers. The way led far beyond the Harkonnen patrols. He knew how it would be. The dreams had shown him. One day, as they went, there'd be a faint change of colour on the far horizon, such a slight change that he might feel he was imagining it out of his hopes. And there would be the new Sietch.
"Does my decision suit, Muad'Dib?"
Stilgar asked. Only the faintest touch of sarcasm tinged his voice, but Fremen ears around them, alert to every tone in a bird's cry, or Isielago's piping message, heard the sarcasm and watched Paul to see what he would do.
"Stilgar heard me swear my loyalty to him when we consecrated the Fedaikin," Paul said. "My death commandos know I spoke with honour. Does Stilgar doubt it?"
Real pain exposed itself in Paul's voice. Stilgar heard it and lowered his gaze.
"Usul, the companion of my Sietch, him I would never doubt," Stilgar said. "But you are Paul Muad'Dib, the Atreides Duke, and you are the Lisan al-Ghaib, the voice from the outer world. These men I don't even know."
Paul turned away to watch the Habania Ridge climb out of the desert. The Maker beneath them still felt strong and willing. It could carry them almost twice the distance of any other in Fremen experience. He knew it. There was nothing outside the stories told to children that could match this old man of the desert. It was the stuff of a new legend, Paul realized. A hand gripped his shoulder. Paul looked at it, followed the arm to the face beyond it, the dark eyes of Stilgar exposed between filter mask and stillsuit hood.
"The one who led Tabur Sietch before me," Stilgar said. "He was my friend. We shared dangers. He owed me his life many a time, and I owed him mine."
"I am your friend, Stilgar," Paul said.
"No man doubts it," Stilgar said.
He removed his hand, shrugged.
"It's the way."
Paul saw that Stilgar was too immersed in the Fremen way to consider the possibility of any other. Here a leader took the reins from the dead hands of his predecessor, or slew among the strongest of his tribe if a leader died in the desert. Stilgar had risen to be a Naib in that way.
"We should leave this Maker in deep sand," Paul said.
"Yes,"
Stilgar agreed.
"We could walk to the cave from here."
"We've ridden him far enough that he'll bury himself and sulk for a day or so," Paul said.
"You're the Mudir of the sand ride," Stilgar said. "Say when we—"
He broke off, stared at the eastern sky. Paul whirled. The spice-blue overcast of his eyes made the sky appear dark, a richly filtered azure against which a distant rhythmic flashing stood out in sharp contrast. "Ornithopter."
"One small thopter," Stilgar said.
"Could be a scout," Paul said. "Do you think they've seen us?"
"At this distance we're just a worm on the surface," Stilgar said.
He motioned with his left hand.
"Off! Scatter on the sand!"
The troop began working down the worm's sides, dropping off, blending with the sand beneath their cloaks. Paul marked where Cheney dropped. Presently only he and Stilgar remained.
"First up, last off," Paul said.
Stilgar nodded, dropping down the side on his hooks, leaping onto the sand. Paul waited until the Maker was safely clear of the scatter area, then released his hooks. This was the tricky moment, with a worm not completely exhausted. Freed of its goads and hooks, the big worm began burrowing into the sand. Paul ran lightly back along its broad surface, judged his moment carefully, and leaped off. He landed running, lunged against the slip face of a dune the way he had been taught, and hid himself beneath the cascade of sand over his robe. Now the waiting. Paul turned gently, exposed a crack of sky beneath a crease in his robe. He imagined the others back along their path doing the same. He heard the beat of the thopter's wings before he saw it. There was a whisper of jet pods, and it came over his patch of desert, turned in a broad arc toward the ridge. An unmarked thopter, Paul noted. It flew out of sight beyond Habanya Ridge. A bird cry sounded over the desert. Another. Paul shook himself free of sand, climbed to the dune top. Other figures stood out in a line, trailing away from the ridge. He recognized Cheney and Stilgar among them. Stilgar signaled toward the ridge. They gathered and began the sand walk, gliding over the surface in a broken rhythm that would disturb no maker. Stilgar paced himself beside Paul along the wind-packed crest of a dune.
"It was a smuggler craft," Stilgar said.
"So it seemed," Paul said, "but this is deep into the desert for smugglers."
"They've their difficulties with patrols, too," Stilgar said.
"If they come this deep, they may go deeper," Paul said.
"True.
It wouldn't be well for them to see what they could see if they ventured too deep into the south. Smugglers sell information, too."
"They were hunting spice, don't you think?" Stilgar asked.
"There will be a wing and a crawler waiting somewhere for that one," Paul said. "We've spice. Let's bait a patch of sand and catch us some smugglers. They should be taught that this is our land, and our men need practice with the new weapons."
"Now Usul speaks," Stilgar said.
"Usul thinks Fremen."
"But Usul must give way to decisions that match a terrible purpose," Paul thought. And the storm was gathering.
When law and duty are one, united by religion, you never become fully conscious, fully aware of yourself. You are always a little less than an individual. From Muad'Dib, The 99 Wonders of the Universe, by Princess Irulan.
The smuggler's spice factory, with its parent carrier and ring of drone ornithopters, came over a lifting of dunes like a swarm of insects following its queen. Ahead of the swarm lay one of the low rock ridges that lifted from the desert floor like small imitations of the shield wall. The dry beaches of the ridge were swept clean by a recent storm. In the con bubble of the factory, Gurney Halleck leaned forward, adjusted the oil lenses of his binoculars, and examined the landscape. Beyond the ridge, he could see a dark patch that might be a spice blow, and he gave the signal to a hovering ornithopter that sent it to investigate. The thopter waggled its wings to indicate it had the signal. It broke away from the swarm, sped down toward the darkened sand, circled the area with its detectors dangling close to the surface. Almost immediately, it went through the wing-tucked dip and circle that told the waiting factory that spice had been found. Gurney sheathed his binoculars, knowing the others had seen the signal.
He liked this spot. The ridge offered some shielding and protection. This was deep in the desert, an unlikely place for an ambush.
Still, Gurney signaled for a crew to hover over the ridge, to scan it, sent reserves to take up station in pattern around the area, not too high, because then they could be seen from afar by Harkonnen detectors. He doubted, though, that Harkonnen patrols would be this far south. This was still Fremen country. Gurney checked his weapons, damning the fate that made shields useless out here. Anything that summoned a worm had to be avoided at all costs. He rubbed the ink-vine scar along his jaw, studying the scene, decided it would be safest to lead a ground party through the ridge. Inspection on foot was still the most certain. You couldn't be too careful when Fremen and Harkonnen were at each other's throats. It was Fremen that worried him here. They didn't mind trading for all the spice you could afford, but they were devils on the warpath if you stepped foot where they forbade you to go. And they were so devilishly cunning of late. It annoyed Gurney, the cunning and adroitness in battle of these natives. They displayed a sophistication in warfare as good as anything he had ever encountered, and he had been trained by the best fighters in the universe, then seasoned in battles where only the superior few survived. Again Gurney scanned the landscape, wondering why he felt uneasy. Perhaps it was the worm they had seen. But that was on the other side of the ridge. A head popped up into the con bubble beside Gurney, the factory commander, a one-eyed old pirate with full beard, the blue eyes and milky teeth of a spice diet.
"Looks like a rich patch, sir. Shall I take her in?"
"Come down at the edge of that ridge. Let me disembark with my men. You can tractor her out to the spice from there. We'll have a look at that rock."
"Aye."
"In case of trouble, save the factory. We'll lift in the thopters."
The factory commander saluted.
"Aye, sir."
He popped back down through the hatch. Again Gurney scanned the horizon. He had to respect the possibility that there were Fremen here and he was trespassing. Fremen worried him, their toughness and unpredictability. Many things about this business worried him, but the rewards were great. The fact that he couldn't send spotters high overhead worried him too. The necessity of radio silence added to his uneasiness. The factory crawler turned, began to descend. Gently it glided down to the dry beach at the foot of the ridge. Treads touched sand. Gurney opened the bubble dome, released his safety straps. The instant the factory stopped, he was out, slamming the bubble closed behind him, scrambling out over the tread guards to swing down to the sand beyond the emergency netting. The five men of his personal guard were out with him, emerging from the nose hatch. Others released the factory's carrier wing. It detached, lifted away to fly in a parking circle low overhead. Immediately the big factory crawler lurched off, swinging away from the ridge toward the dark patch of spice out on the sand. A thopter swooped down nearby, skidded to a stop. Another followed, and another. They disgorged Gurney's platoon and lifted to hover flight. Gurney tested his muscles in his stillsuit, stretching. He left the filter mask off his face, losing moisture for the sake of a greater need, the carrying power of his voice if he had to shout commands. He began climbing up into the rocks, checking the terrain, pebbles and pea sand underfoot, the smell of spice. "Good sight for an emergency base," he thought. "Might be sensible to bury a few supplies here." He glanced back, watching his men spread out as they followed him. Good men. Even the new ones he hadn't had time to test. Good men. Didn't have to be told every time what to do. Not a shield glimmer showed on any of them. No cowards in this bunch, carrying shields into the desert where a worm could sense the field and come to rob them of the spice they found. From this slight elevation in the rocks, Gurney could see the spice patch about half a kilometer away and the crawler just reaching the near edge. He glanced up at the cover flight, noting the altitude, not too high. He nodded to himself, turned to resume his climb up the ridge. In that instant, the ridge erupted. 12 roaring paths of flame streaked upward to the hovering thopters and carrier wing. There came a blasting of metal from the factory crawler, and the rocks around Gurney were full of hooded, fighting men. Gurney had time to think, "By the horns of the Great Mother, rockets! They dare to use rockets!" Then he was face to face with a hooded figure who crouched low, Chris knife at the ready. 2 more men stood waiting on the rocks above, to left and right. Only the eyes of the fighting man ahead of him were visible to Gurney, between hood and veil of a sand-coloured burnous. But the crouch and readiness warned him that here was a trained fighting man. The eyes were the blue-in-blue of the deep desert Fremen. Gurney moved one hand toward his own knife, kept his eyes fixed on the other's knife. If they dared use rockets, they'd have other projectile weapons. This moment argued extreme caution. He could tell by sound alone that at least part of his sky cover had been knocked out. There were gruntings, too, the noise of several struggles behind him. The eyes of the fighting man ahead of Gurney followed the motion of hand toward knife, came back to glare into Gurney's eyes.
Leave the knife in its sheath, Gurney Halleck.
Gurney hesitated. That voice sounded oddly familiar, even through a still-suit filter.
You know my name?
You've no need of a knife with me, Gurney.
The man straightened, slipped his Chris knife into its sheath back beneath his robe.
Tell your men to stop their useless resistance.
The man threw his hood back, swung the filter aside. The shock of what he saw froze Gurney's muscles. He thought at first he was looking at a ghost image of Duke Leto Atreides. Full recognition came slowly.
Paul? Is it truly Paul?
Don't you trust your own eyes?
I said you were dead.
Gurney took a half step forward.
Tell your men to submit.
Paul waved toward the lower reaches of the ridge. Gurney turned, reluctant to take his eyes off Paul. He saw only a few knots of struggle. Hooded desert men seemed to be everywhere around. The factory crawler lay silent, with Fremen standing atop it. There were no aircraft overhead.